Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and I'm happy to say that today we have Ruha Benjamin on the show, and we're going to be talking about her terrific new book just out from Polity Press called Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. We'll have to talk about that expression, New Jim Code. We will do that. So, Ruha, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm trained as a sociologist. I'm currently an associate professor of African American studies at Princeton. And within sociology, my specialty is looking at the social dimensions of science, technology, and medicine. So broadly speaking, I'm interested in the relationship between innovation and inequity.
Mm-hmm. I really thought your book was very interesting. And it reminded me of something that occurred to me when I was shopping at a place called Stop and Shop here in Massachusetts. It was in Boston, actually, in the 1990s, I think. It might have been the late 80s. And this is when barcodes were first introduced, I think. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking, they're going to know everything I buy. Because I was paying with a credit card. They're going to know every god darn thing I buy. That's incredible. And then they're going to be able to pitch me. I mean, me. Just the exactly. Marshall Poe, like what Marshall Poe wants. I'm like, that's incredible. Because I knew a little bit about databases and information technology. So I was kind of aware of that. And then once I started to buy everything online, as everyone does, I'm like, now they really know everything I buy.
Exactly.
That's kind of scary.
Exactly. The early days of targeted advertising is what you're describing.
Right. And I'm sure you've had the experience of like getting on Google and like seeing those ads up above, you know, when they, or even on your email and like, hey, I kind of want that. How do they know I want that?
Totally. You were just searching for it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. How do they know that? That's kind of freaky.
Exactly.
That's really kind of what your book is about. It's about, I used to work in a big corporation and we talked about segments and verticals. Mm. It was all segments and verticals.
Exactly.
And how you get into them. So why don't you begin by telling us why you wrote Race After Technology?
Sure thing. So a few years ago, I was on a sabbatical and I was working on a different project altogether. And I kept noticing these headlines and hot takes about so-called racist robots. There are all kinds of stories in the news that initially seemed really surprised at the idea that technology and robots as a kind of heuristic for automation more broadly could be in some way biased. And then there was a second wave of headlines, it was less surprised, but was kind of like, duh, of course, you know, technology inherits its creators' biases. And now I think I've seen it evolve where people are starting to acknowledge that this is possible and people are trying to come up with all kinds of interventions and tweaks and fixes for what some call algorithmic discrimination or machine bias. And I was interested to bring the large literature around racism, sociology of race and inequality to bear on these questions, because in some ways it seemed as if the framing of it was as if it was some new phenomenon rather than an extension of longstanding forms of inequality. So I wanted to look at how computer systems were an extension of other kinds of systemic forms of inequality, whether in the legal system, educational system, healthcare system rather than as some kind of completely new phenomenon. So that motivated me to write the book. Mm-hmm.
And well, let's jump right into it. And you have this really very evocative expression, the new Jim Code. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So that's one of these concepts that I'm trying to use to evoke the history of racial discrimination in this country, looking to Jim Crow segregation as, one particular period of white supremacist legal discrimination in this country, and then riffing off of Michelle Alexander's analysis in her book, The New Jim Crow, in which she's looking at how mass incarceration is an extension, is a next institution of racial control and racial discrimination. So within that genealogy, I'm interested in how technology exacerbates, it reproduces, or even hides discrimination. And to get at that technological aspect of it, I substituted New Jim Crow for New Jim Code so we can think about how computer systems enable longstanding forms of discrimination by race, class, gender, or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So that's a nice segue. Can you give us some examples of the ways in which computer technologies do these things?
Absolutely. So just a couple weeks ago, some colleagues of mine got access long before the study was published a couple weeks ago about a healthcare algorithm that's used throughout our healthcare system affecting millions and millions of patients. And what they found by studying the algorithm was that it disproportionately excluded Black patients from needed care. And so this is a kind of software system that flags patients before they get really sick to try to intervene to prevent some of the illnesses that they see coming down the line. And because of the way that the algorithm is designed, it used past healthcare costs as a proxy for healthcare needs. So it used how much we spend on patients in the past as a way to predict how sick they will get in the future. However, on average, we spend white patients incur much more in terms of cost than Black patients for a variety of reasons. And so if we spend less on Black patients, then according to this system, they would require less attention in the future when in fact they often were sicker at a certain risk point in terms of this algorithm. And so what we found, what my colleagues found, and what then I did in my review piece in Science was show how the program designers and the people who implemented, because they weren't taking into consideration this history of past forms of discrimination, they unwittingly reproduced health disparities by excluding Black patients from future health sort of preventative care. And so this is one example in which it's not malicious intent. It's not the desire to actively harm Black people in the healthcare system, but it's an indifference to this history of exclusion and disparity in the past that reproduces it into the future and ensures that the people who most need a particular form of service or care are not going to get it.
And this would be true generally of people who don't spend very much on healthcare because they don't have very much.
Absolutely. And so in that way, it's a race neutral algorithm. But because the race and class are so intertwined in this country, that it's disproportionately affecting Black patients in this particular case. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask a question about, I'm trying to think how to best put this, about the kind of conundrum which I think a lot of businesses face, because businesses, you know, they have to be profitable if they're going to continue to offer the services and goods that they provide. And you work in the world you have, not in the world you want. So it seems to me like a lot of them, and I certainly take your point that none of this is malicious, they're kind of forced in this direction of, and I'm thinking of targeting in particular, and the ways in which I'm targeted and people I know are targeted, you really have to cater to the clientele that can pay you. And I'm wondering, like, if you were talking to somebody who ran one of these businesses or something, what would you suggest that they do to take into consideration these histories of inequality and racism, things like this?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, part of my concern is that so many of the technologies that are being developed are being both developed and implemented in what we might think of as the private sector, but they have all of these public policy implications. And so what my concern is not necessarily to advise the private sector, but for us to actually invest a lot more in public interest technologies. And so from the get-go, sort of from the development phase, from the problem posing phase of what technologies we even need in the first place, not even just applying them, how can we put public values at the forefront rather than allowing a profit imperative to drive this? Because as you note in your question, so long as the bottom line is the kind of driving force and kind of trumps other kinds of values in the process, I don't think we're going to sort of be able to skirt or tweak our way out of technology reinforcing inequities, so long as that's the motivator. And so I think we need, you know, in terms of our focus and investment is to really think about what public interest technologies might look like and where that they might be developed.
Mm-hmm. And where would that investment come from?
So a lot of the starting of point, I think, is to think about the intellectual foundations of technological development. A lot of academic centers are being started and reinvested in that can provide the intellectual foundations of technological development. So there's that. There's a lot of research centers that are kind of hybrid centers that put public values at their forefront. I think about the Data and Society Research Center Institute in New York City as one. Another one is called AI Now. And so again, it's not centers that are simply about criticizing technological development, but are trying to bring together technologists who want to put public values at the forefront of their work and putting them in collaboration with communities, advocates, people in policy who also have that as their core ethic. And so on my personal website, ruhabenjamin.com, I have a resources tab with a long list of initiatives, centers, individuals who are working along these lines.
Uh-huh. And can you mention some of them? I mean, you mentioned
sure.
A couple, yeah.
Yeah. So sure. Another one is called the Algorithmic Justice League out of MIT. One of the researchers who was at the forefront of exposing the discrimination embedded in facial recognition technologies a few years ago, Joy Bulamwini, after she conducted the research, she actually started the Algorithmic Justice League. That is a network of people who are working to address the biases that are reproduced through algorithms and computer systems. And so that's another one. There's also a lot of community-based organizations that work under the rubric of tech justice. And so the Data for Black Lives is a national network of thousands of people who are a combination of technologists, a lot of people working in STEM, but working alongside advocates and policy folks, communities. And so that's an annual conference and a network that is really on fire in terms of attracting people who want to think about the public values that need to guide technology. And then in terms of community organizations, Detroit has a really great organization called the Detroit Community Tech Justice Initiative that is become a model for a lot of other local initiatives around the country. And so, you know, again, the list goes on and on. And a lot of these organizations have produced different kinds of tools and handbooks that I describe in chapter 5 of my book that can be adapted in other locales. And so both tools and sort of ways to facilitate civic conversations around this. And so I would encourage listeners who maybe can't find a local organization where they are to draw upon these resources and maybe initiate this. And so the idea is that we just need a lot more people in the conversation and actively involved, not just the people who have the tech knowledge, but also the social and cultural background and knowledge, because the issues that we're talking about are really too important to leave to those who have one type of expertise when there's many issues that are implicated in and tech injustice. And so we need to think about this in terms of a broader polity, a democratic approach and participatory approach to tech development.
Mm-hmm. I want to broaden the discussion a little bit and bring it back to what I said at the beginning of the interview. And that is, much of your book is about targeting. And I know that, you know, I run the New Books Network and we do a lot of targeting and we use social media to do it. And we target people that are interested in things like East Asian studies or sociology or something like that. But I wonder if you had, you know, the thing about targeting is that, you know, it's good in one way. I mean, I think it's great that Google can show me things that I might want that I didn't know about. And then really that's kind of what we do in the New Books Network is we show people things that they opt into, that they want, that they would. But on the other hand, it does kind of, you know, I'm really struggling on how to put this, but I'm a type of person. And it further typifies me.
Yes. There's a reductive aspect to it. And one way to think about what the flip side of targeted advertising or tailored advertising is when powerful institutions target you in a way that's more akin to surveillance rather than sort of marketing. And so, you know, part of what we want to think about in terms of the duplicity of technology, the fact that it can have this upside, but it can have this underside that we are not often really privy to, is that it really matters the larger infrastructure that the technology is being wielded in. And so whether that has to do with the institution or the people that are behind the scenes, with what guiding assumptions and values, what kind of system is it being enrolled to further? And so it's not enough to just evaluate the technology in isolation from this broader network or this broader infrastructure. And so that's why we need to think about, you know, what comes before even the development of any technology, who's around the table, what is the problem that technology is even meant to solve and intervene in. And so I would agree with you that part of the real allure and the reason why many people until very recently haven't necessarily questioned how deeply these technologies are penetrating our everyday life is because it makes us feel seen in particular ways and recognized as somehow unique. We don't necessarily experience it as being typified. We experience it as being like, wow, my screen, you know, my sort of search engine knows exactly what I'm interested in, you know? And so there's a sense of feeling recognized rather than simply lumped together that creates a consumer demand for many of these technologies that we have to recognize has a deep underside when that data is used in ways that can control us and sort of put us in certain boxes and further be used by institutions that don't have our best interests at heart. And some groups are more vulnerable to this misuse and this surveillance than others. And so that's part of what we want to recognize is that for some people, it's no big deal. It's like, sure, you know, get all my data so that I can like buy the best products and have the best things sold to me. And there are some groups for whom that data it can really come to harm or exclude or lock you out of certain opportunities. The same types of targeted, the forms that companies use, let's say, to make sure that you see an ad that you really need, that same form allows them to actually exclude certain groups. So for example, if I'm a housing developer and I'm going to fill out I want to get my housing ads in front of the eyes of a certain demographic, the same moment that I'm choosing which demographics I want to see my ad, I can also choose who I don't want to see. And that can include elderly people. That can include people with children. Yeah. That can include Black and Latinx communities. And so this is a way in which old school forms of discrimination that took the form, for example, of, you know, I think of my grandma's neighborhood in LA where I have this this ad that housing developers used in which they only wanted white home buyers in that neighborhood. And so they, in trying to attract them there, they said, come buy these houses because we have beneficial restrictions built into the housing. So that meant we are going to exclude Negroes from infiltrating this neighborhood. That was an old school targeted advertisement that we think it was like of days gone by. But now you can go and do the same thing behind the screen and ensure that Black people don't see your ad. Right now, there's a lawsuit, class action lawsuit against some developers who are excluding elderly people from seeing housing ads in DC. So it's an example of, you know, the underside of being seen is that some people are being excluded, and we have to reckon with that duplicity.
Yeah, I want to say to all the marketers out there that I actually want to see the Porsche ads. I can't afford a Porsche, but I want to see them. God damn it.
You want to see them?
I love cars. I really do. I drive up a beat up minivan for my kids. But man, I want to see those Porsche ads. Can you send those to me, please?
Yeah, but then because you're not likely to click on it, or maybe they don't want to waste it on you. And so, you know.
No Porsches.
Yeah.
It's also funny it's also funny you mentioned it reminds me of something from my youth, which was a heck of a long time ago.
Yeah.
In Kansas, actually. And I used to really like Michael Jackson a lot. And
we share that very, in common.
Very incredible guy. Really. I'm sure there are politics around it. I don't want to go into that, but I liked his music a lot. I'm personally think that Off the Wall was his best album. That's just me. I don't know. But
yeah.
I remember that suddenly there was this thing, urban radio. Remember that?
Like, that's a great example. Yeah,
That didn't exist. It all of a sudden existed. Urban radio. I'm like, what does that mean exactly? Urban radio.
Yeah. And so that's a great example of code words. And so before we even get to the encoding in like technical systems, our language encodes difference, and it signals certain things without making it explicit. And so racially coded language like urban is one of those ways in which you're invoking a certain listener, and you're also trying to push away people who wouldn't necessarily be interested in whatever comes with that coded, that term.
Yeah. But there's kind of two sides to this coin. It's a very sensitive issue because for the people who are promoting what is essentially Black music, or what we would call Black music, I don't know if there is such a thing, but let's just say that there is from the marketer's point of view. That establishing urban radio as a thing helped produce urban radio stations, which are now quite profitable enterprises that actually serve, I guess, African Americans. You know, I mean, I don't know. It didn't exist when I was a kid. We had country and top 40, and Michael Jackson was on the top 40 radio station, right?
Yeah.
So it's a hard, you know, it established this community of interest on the one hand. But on the other hand, it kind of, I felt a little excluded from urban radio, to be honest with you, as a white guy.
Absolutely. And I think that it's that mix of, you know, the kind of the upside. And we always have to ask, you know, whose interest does it serve ultimately, you know, to have these form segmented markets and, you know, the sort of targeted advertising and so on. Because certainly part of what drives it is that there is a big upside. People are really profiting off of the segmentation and this tailoring. And so we want to sort of complicate that experience by looking also at who is potentially harmed or excluded. In the case of the music world and radio, it may not be as, the stakes may not be as high, but when you think of job opportunities being excluded from that, or being able to get a loan on a house, or being able to access certain forms of healthcare, the stakes of, you know, being left out of a kind of digital targeting can be life and death in some cases, as the healthcare example shows.
Yeah, that's certainly true, and that's a very serious matter. But it seems to me that you could just as easily tweak that an entrepreneur could come along and say, well, these algorithms that these big medical companies have are excluding this population. I could probably serve this population in the sense of giving them some good or service that would be of value to them. So I'll make my own algorithm.
In fact, the researchers that I mentioned are working with the company whose algorithm they expose to actually make it better and to make it work in the way that it was intended, which is to flag patients who need, you know, more attention. And so in that case, the researchers are offering pro bono. And so rather than like another company coming in and making a profit off of it, they're saying, well, it's too important to leave it to that. And so they're actually helping the company develop it in a way that won't have this racial disparity as the outcome.
Well, and I should say, you don't need to be an expert in medical demographics to know that there are a lot of underserved populations in the United States, and that and that is a market that you could probably serve in some sort of sensible and useful way.
Yeah.
So you can actually, you could design an algorithm that actually goes after those people and essentially offers them some good or service that would be, you know, of value to them. I wouldn't want to lose that market segment either if I were in the insurance trade or the housing trade or whatever it is, because it's really in their best interest, of course, to go provide those people with goods and services because they probably want them.
And certainly that is definitely one way forward. Another is to really think about, you know, whether it's healthcare or housing, any of these things that are sort of basic to people's well-being, whether we should just leave it to, you know, market opportunists to step in, you know, because if that's the case, going back to your first provocation, it's likely that if a certain population is not seen as profitable, if not seen as having sort of, you know, market power, then they're going to continue to be underserved. And so just leaving it to the whims of the market, I think when it comes to especially the basic needs that people have to be well and to live a good life, we need to think about what other kind of public accountability and public sort of apparatus infrastructure we need if we're going to turn to technology to address these, rather than just leaving it to simply hoping that good actors in the market will step in to serve different groups. Because at least for, you know, racialized populations in this country, poor people in this country, they've often not been served by leaving it completely to, business to come in with healthcare and housing and so on.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Because I mean, you know, I guess I run a business now, and I know that I need to find a clientele. We do advertising on the New Books Network, and I know that advertising is targeted. So for example, we get a lot of ads. They're pumped in by a company that we work with. And so we get a lot of Doctors Without Borders. It's for good reason, because we reach people who are generally liberal. They're very highly educated. They probably know what Doctors Without Borders is, and they probably have the disposable income to donate to Doctors Without Borders. And you, by the way, you should donate to Doctors Without Borders.
Good plan.
So, we don't get a lot of, other kinds of ads pumped in because they're targeting. And, you know, I can just hear it when I hear the ads. I know what kind of ads that we get, and they are for people that are generally well-educated and probably have disposable income.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so certainly this area of targeted advertisement and sort of social media exclusion, inclusion is one really important site of the new Jim Code. And there are so many others that I think are more hidden, in which you don't see it on your screen at all. You are excluded or you're harmed by a system without being fully cognizant. And that's why in some ways, the distinction with older forms of racial discrimination is that you can't point to a racist boogeyman. You can't point to the racist judge or the racist doctor, because it's a computer system that's making decisions that are reproducing these past forms of discrimination. But the who to hold responsible is much harder in this case.
Yeah, because it's so funny, because I was just reading Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson. And, you know, back when Lyndon Johnson was coming up, there were like, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but there were real racists, like explicit racists, segregationists. But now we have this kind of racism without racists, which is very, it's a tough thing. You know, and again, I don't mean to say there aren't racists. There definitely are racists, but
there definitely are.
It's just not as explicit as it used to be. I want to come back to something you said, and that is that you hear a lot of criticism, especially among the chattering classes on Twitter and things like this, about censorship and discrimination on platforms like Twitter and like Facebook and YouTube, but it's almost always political. Conservatives are saying they're being banned, or liberals are saying they're being banned, shadow banned, I think is what it's called. But you never hear about this deeper kind of bias that you're talking about.
Yeah. So, like, you know, all
you should write an op-ed.
I that's a good idea. I'll tell them you sent me.
Yeah, you're right enough bad about that.
But that's right. It's like the social media form of this monopolizes a lot of the airwave, a lot of the public attention. And I think what we really need to also sort of draw into the conversation is how almost every facet of our lives in some way is being shaped by automated decision systems, whether it's in finance or whether it's in our educational system, public benefit system, all of the aspects of our lives. But it's this, the social media aspect of, because we spend so much time in that sort of forum, where the discrimination or the exclusion is happening there seems to get a lot of attention. And so what I'm trying to do with the book is to zoom the lens out a bit and to show how in our criminal justice system, we're seeing this. And again, when a system, an automated system that seems to take the human agency or subjectivity out of the equation is actually just hiding the human decisions that went into the production of it. And that's what I'm trying to excavate through the book, to show how past patterns of making decision are the input for these predictive systems or these automated systems, rather than thinking that technology grows on trees and somehow is going to be more objective than we mere humans.
It's funny you mentioned this, because sometimes they go awry in really hilarious ways. I got a robocall that was entirely in Chinese. My last name's Po. Right. So, I can't imagine how I got it, but it was entirely in Chinese. I mean,
that's such a great example, because there's no harm. You kind of just chuckle and hang up. But so that same faulty, you know, aspect that you experienced through the robocall, it's actually it's wreaked havoc in people's lives, because these systems do make all kinds of mistakes. And so I'm thinking now of, you know, the state of Michigan, where Governor Snyder at the time adopted an automated decision system to flag people who were engaged in unemployment fraud. And so the system flagged tens of thousands of people and had people paying back money to the state that they actually didn't owe. People went bankrupt, they lost their homes, filed for divorce, some people committed suicide, all because they had this system that had incorrectly flagged them as engaged in unemployment fraud. Now there's a class action lawsuit against the state, but that's an example where the mistakes built into the system had real dire consequences for people's lives. And yet it was, again, all framed under the rubric of being more efficient, being more fair than if humans did it, or with an old kind of computer system did it. And so, you know, I think we should use the funny examples as an entry point to think about how, when the same sort of glitches are taking shape in other aspects of our lives, we really need to pay attention.
Yeah, well, one of the aspects of our lives that I'm particularly concerned about is financial services. Now, I know quite a bit about finance, and I have stocks and bonds and a retirement account and all this other stuff, and I was raised to know about these things, but a lot of people don't. And I do all my banking locally, so I know my banker. But I'm constantly bombarded with these offers for easy loans and credit cards I don't need. And I work with a lot of people that are essentially they're addicts and alcoholics, and these people don't they don't know anything about this. It just looks like kind of manna from
heaven
for them. Easy money, right? Easy money is the right. But they just don't know what they're getting into.
Yeah.
And if they actually talked to a person who was sensible and had their interests in mind,
yeah,
they'd say, you don't want this credit card. This is not a good thing for you. You don't need this. And you're likely to misuse it in some way, not out of any maliciousness, but you just don't understand the way these things are structured. And and I'm very concerned about that, you know, that aspect of targeting. You know, like you could target people without credit cards and try to give them credit cards. I don't know if that'd be a good business decision, but they do it.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you're right to feel wary about it. I was just in Nairobi, Kenya, in August, and giving a talk to African computer scientists from across the continent. And so I was looking for like local examples to kind of illustrate some of the concepts and the principles I'd been thinking about more in the US context. And what I came across was the way in which US financial tech companies had basically, you know, targeted people in Kenya with all of these easy money apps, where such a large portion of the population now is indebted, taking money from one app to pay their loans to another. And for me, one of the most troublesome aspects of it is the way that the stigma around debt is being actively used to, you know, both surveil people and to try to, you know, get and more data on the part of these companies, because the more data they get from the people who sign up for these apps, it actually makes it feeds their algorithms in terms of who then to target. And so they'll call people's parents, their employers, in order to try to get back the money owed. And, you know, in some ways, the narrative around access to this money is one of like empowerment, banking the unbanked, people who haven't had access to traditional kinds of finance now have access to this easy money. So the narrative is all empowerment. But when you look carefully at it, people are really making money off of people's perpetual indebtedness. The point is to stay in debt, you know, to keep people in debt. And so I think in that case, we can learn it's a slightly more advanced version of what you're describing, in which a vast majority of the population are that's where the majority of their financing and loans come from, are through companies, not even Kenyan companies, right? Companies based in Silicon Valley that are taking advantage in many ways off of people's need to finance basic aspects, you know, whether it's healthcare, education, and so on.
Yeah, I know enough not to piss off, if you'll pardon the expression, credit card companies. But credit cards are strange things, sort of sociologically, because they are a business that relies for its profitability on your bad behavior.
Yes.
Credit card companies hate me because I always pay on time. They hate me. They lose tons of money on me because I always pay it off on time. Now, credit is obviously a very, very good thing. You need to have credit. That's absolutely essential. And it's interesting you mentioned being unbanked, because a lot of the people that I work with have been unbanked, largely due to their own bad behavior. But then, you know, they get these offers of from some bank somewhere, I don't know where, that offers to open a bank account for them. I mean, and again, it's this duality. It's on the one hand, that's good because they can start the road to credit worthiness. But on the other hand, and I always tell them the same thing. I'm like, go down to East Hampton Savings Bank and talk to Joan, because Joan knows me. And she'll set you up, okay?
Yeah.
And I'll explain who you are to her. And then we'll get you something that will suit you. Not this thing that you found on the internet because you were targeted, because you were unbanked. It's incredible that that information is even available.
Yeah.
That you were unbanked. Because that stuff just follows you around, man.
Absolutely. And for anyone who wants to dig in more to this, again, it's not my area of expertise, the financial tech issues, but I have a colleague, Tamara Knopper, who contributed a chapter to my other book, Captivating Technology. So you look up Tamara Knopper and Captivating Technology. She does a deep dive into this way in which our, as you said, credit worthiness is being enfolded into this broader category of digital character, how our character, all of our activities online are being quantified. And so we hear sometimes about like the dystopic sort of version of a citizen score in China,
right,
and that, you know, tracks everything that you do and your trustworthiness and so on. But there are versions of this being
rolled out here, right?
Yeah,
that evolved organically here.
Yeah. And so we need to, and it's interesting because the companies that are in the business of, you know, this broader version of like quantifying our credit worthiness based on all kinds of things that we do online and even our social networks. That is, if someone you know, and so this might be interesting for you, who we're talking about the people that you know, if people that you know default on loans, that is enrolled into your score. That is because of your social networking activities, they will know if people in your network have defaulted or you know, not paid on time. And so this is a way in which the more and more data that is collected is likely to be used against us, even if our own individual behavior we deem to be responsible. That's not holding up in this broader form of quantification. And so this means that we should care about the wider system, even if we think that we're behaving in a way that is going to garner some kind of reward through these systems, because it's going to come back to harm us.
Yeah, I work with a contractor. I'm renovating the house that I live in now, and I work with this contractor. He's a great guy, and he was unbanked at one time, I imagine, but he keeps a very careful track of his own credit score, which is extraordinarily good. I don't know how he does it, but he's really tweaked it. Like, I always pay off, and mine is as good as his. But he was setting up an account at a Sherwin-Williams, and they said to him, we need to check your credit. And he knew enough to say, is that a hard check or a soft check? Because if it's a hard check, I think he called it a hard check, mm-hmm, that affects your credit score.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Just checking. Right.
And he's like, if it's a hard check, I don't want it done.
Wow.
Who knew? Yeah. I had no idea about this stuff, man. Come on. Who knows this stuff?
Most people don't. Yeah. But there's a benefit to keeping people in the dark about these things too, you know?
So yeah, hard check.
I mean, part what motivates me in both the writing of the book and just going around and talking to different communities is that, you know, in terms of public awareness and consciousness about how now technology is mediating these longstanding forms of, you know, whether it's exploitation or, you know, whatever the context is, we need to have more people aware of the implications of certain technical systems in our lives so that we can question it and have people representing us in office who are more knowledgeable and more willing to hold these tech companies accountable.
Well, and not only that, might I suggest that some of these companies should like hire some sociologists?
They are, you know, it's funny. In the last couple of years, I read somewhere, it's called the tech lash, the backlash against tech in the last, you know, since say Cambridge Analytica and a few of the other scandals. And so in fact, many of these companies are, you know, kind of trying to address the criticism from what's kind of insider ball. And so they are hiring philosophers, sociologists, anthropologists. But I think that is, you know, that's good on one level, but it's still, we need more independent oversight, kind of leaving it to the people who are creating the problem to also create the solution and police themselves. We need to think about what a deeper form of accountability might look like. And so they're following your advice. But that kind of domestication of the critique by having insiders, because ultimately, if you work for a company, how likely are you to really offer hard criticism or flag things if that's where your paycheck is coming from, even if you are a sociologist, right? And so we need some more independent forms of accountability in the world that we're living in right now.
So you mentioned the word oversight, and oversight is a word that a lot of people are uncomfortable with. What would this oversight look like in your dream world?
You know, because I am part of the work is geared towards criticizing predictive and prescriptive forms of technological development, I'm also wary of offering policy prescriptions that are just born out of my own sort of imagination. Part of what I'm really trying to advocate is a more democratic participatory approach to both technology on the and tech policy. And so what I would encourage is people to get involved in some of the organizations that I mentioned that are doing both local, national, and international kinds of thinking and deliberation, consultation around what this might look like. On one end of this, it's taking the form of particular kinds of bans and moratoria on technologies that are shown to be both inaccurate and harmful. For example, facial recognition systems. So we have a number of cities around the country, San Francisco to Somerville, where the city, the municipalities are banning facial recognition systems, especially by police. And so that's one end where people are just refusing or stopping the use of particular technologies. And so that's one way to think about what accountability would look like. But I'm interested in more proactive, preventative forms of accountability structures that begin implementing accountability. And by that, I'm thinking about how technologies are likely to affect the most vulnerable in particular populations. So whether that's poor people or racialized groups or women. And so we want to think about how past forms of discrimination, we should assume that these past forms of discrimination are going to be reproduced through automated decision systems unless proven otherwise. Right now, the default assumption is that these are neutral or they're going to be good. And if they happen to have a harmful effects, then we'll deal with it out after the fact. The accountability kicks in after the harm is already demonstrated. And I think we need to assume that the harm will occur unless proven otherwise, unless these issues have been addressed from the get-go. And so for me, one way of thinking about that is in kinds of sort of oversight committees and boards, kind of typical, through our legislative process and so on. But for me, the education system is another site in which we start to seed ways of thinking about technological accountability before we even get to the point of developing technology. How should we train students and practitioners in STEM fields differently so that they're thinking about the ethical and political dimensions of their work well before someone is funding them to develop some algorithmic system? Rather than thinking about that's someone else's job, what about really onboarding these issues and questions in the training? And since I'm a teacher at heart, like that's where I tend to put most of my energy. I know lots of different groups and people who are thinking at other aspects of this, whether it's the policy or litigation, thinking about accountability in the context of litigation and so on. But I'm thinking about seeding ways of thinking and accountable accountability through our higher education system. Right now, students either get a very token kind of exposure to the ethical dimensions of their work, one class here, one lecture here. It's very optional. If you happen to care about these issues, then maybe you get some exposure to it. But I would love to see it integrated more thoroughly into the training of students in the computer sciences, life sciences, and across the board, that is thinking about the social dimensions, political dimensions of their work.
Yeah, I think it's important to be aware in that way. And we try to be here on the New Books Network, so I've mentioned East Asian Studies. I don't want people who are just interested in East Asian Studies to listen to New Books in East Asian Studies.
Yes.
I want a lot of people to listen to it. But I have to say, it is rather targeted right from the get-go because it's called East Asian Studies.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what I can do about that. I want to, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I want to end with a kind of off-the-wall question.
Yeah.
I just finished reading, and I'm kind of ashamed to admit this, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, which I think may be the great American novel now that I've finished reading it. It's alternatively very moving and hilarious. That guy had a great sense of humor. I don't know if you've read it, but the kind of takeaway I got from it is that guy wanted to be treated as an individual. He's constantly stereotyped. First, he's a black guy from the South, and then he goes to New York, and then he's still, he's stereotyped in another way.
Yeah.
He joins what is essentially the Communist Party, stereotyped there. And he's just stereotyped all over the place. And it just drives him up the wall.
Yeah.
Is there any, the American project is to treat us all from, kind of as individuals.
Yeah.
It's like, could that ever happen in the algorithmic world? Is that a possibility? It's so hard.
Yeah, I think, I mean, part of what we, you know, it kind of rounds out where we started with in terms of the inherent reductive goal of these technologies to kind of typify us, create, you know, different groupings, and then make predictions or, you know, decisions based on these groupings. And so in this context, I think it does run counter in the very nature of the technology to think about reducing people to, you know, and I think individual, like whole, like understanding people as whole individuals, right? I think runs counter to it. There is a propensity to think of us as little bits of data, you know, so individual forms of data or composite of these very discrete forms of data, which is a flattening of our individuality. And so I think that it runs counter to your vision of what, you know, a kind of good life or free life would look like in the kind of Ellison version of it. Although I would say that for me, that's not necessarily my vision of liberation or freedom, to be solely kind of a free-floating individual. I think part of how we get meaning in life is to be connected to other people and to think of our, and to work in groups and to think of ourselves as collective. So I would love to see a collective vision of what, you know, a good life would be like, rather than just simply a kind of individualism that we sort of see as the hallmark of freedom in this country.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, because I'm a member of a number of, I guess I would call it groups or communities. They're all pretty much local, except for the New Books Network, which is transnational because we have all these hosts. But I enjoy being a member of those communities, yeah, and I enjoy being identified with them. It's something that I take a great amount of satisfaction in. So I'm really not wholly an individual.
Yeah, I think.
Go ahead.
No, I was thinking that maybe part of the distinction is when those groupings are used against us, when they're ascribed, when we don't have a choice in how we're grouped, when it's something that is imposed on us, I think that's where the oppressive or exploitative nature of collective identity comes from. But when we choose them and when they are fluid and when you can move across groups, and so where there's more agency involved in that sort of collective life, I think that's where the joy comes from, and that's where the positive aspect of sociality comes from. And so part of what, when we think bring it back to the context of data in our digital world, is that most of the digital forms of grouping are coming from the outside. The decision of how to group us and how to use those groupings are out of our hands. And that's where the problem lies. Who controls the kind of the digital apparatus? And so it's not the digital itself that is intrinsically exploitative or oppressive or reinforcing of hierarchies, but it's the power dynamics involved and the fact that a very small slice of humanity currently has control over the digital infrastructure of the world. And that is a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And the problem, which I mentioned, was I don't get any Porsche ads. I know that's to belittle a little bit. I don't mean to do that, but I do bridle at that a little bit, because I don't get those. But I take what you say absolutely, and I agree essentially completely. I do want to be an individual, but then again, I belong to these groups. But I chose to be members of those groups.
Exactly.
And you know, like, I don't know. I'm riffing on this, but like, yeah, when people identify me as white, I'm like, I don't do that.
Yeah.
You're saying that's what I am. I didn't join something called the. It's an accident of my birth.
Yes.
And it's frustrating, you know, when people stereotype, or I'm kind of a big guy, so people make assumptions about me because I'm a big guy, but I'm like, I don't like that exactly. It doesn't feel comfortable. And I think Ellison is very good about this, because people keep looking at him and saying, oh, he's that kind of person.
Absolutely.
So we're going to put him in that box.
Exactly.
I don't know. Ellison must have been a really interesting guy. I imagine he was something of a contrarian and not very much fun at a party.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And the consequences of whether it's size or race or gender, the differences around our differences. So some differences have much greater consequence in our lives.
And so
part of it is thinking, for those who, you know, are experiencing the digital forms of inequality in a more superficial, you know, on a more superficial plane. I think it's important, you know, for listeners who are like, you know, what's the big deal, you know, with targeting, or what's the big deal with risk predictions and so on, because they're often experiencing the overside of these systems, to really recognize that their experience is not, you know, the same as people who are being targeted for being a likely criminal or being a likely defaulter on a loan, because not of their own choices, but because they fit a profile. And so for the people who are experiencing the underside of these systems, the conversation takes on a sort of, you know, a more urgency. And I would encourage those who can't necessarily relate to it at that level to, one, you know, read up on the literature of the people who are trying to theorize this and explain this, but also get connected to communities who are trying to address this, many of whom I mentioned at the top of our interview.
Yeah, well, from your lips to God's ears,
yep.
As they used to say. I don't know if they say that anymore. Do they still say that? I hope they do.
I've heard.
Yeah, it's a good one. Well, let me close the interview by asking our traditional final question, and that is, Ruha, what are you working on now?
So I'm taking a little break, giving myself 2 months until the new year. Not going to any beautiful locations, no clear blue water, but just giving myself a mental break and just enjoying the conversations that are growing out of Race After Technology and Captivating Technology. And then I'm likely to restart a project that I put on hold, looking at the politics of genetics and DNA collection, especially with respect to policing immigrant communities and national identity. And so that project is called The Emperor's New Genes, G-E-N-E-S.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to have you on when you're done with that.
Thank you.
Take your time. let me tell everybody that we've been talking to Ruha Benjamin about her book, Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. It's just out from Polity Press. I really enjoyed the book and I encourage you to go buy it. Ruha, thank you much for being on the show.
A true pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.